Testing.
Of course, the first step in any breeding program, plant breeding program, is to take the land race which exists and which the farmers are growing and do what you can with that while you are developing longer term and more advanced varieties.
Okay, now you were dealing with a crop that had made no appreciable gains in average yield for a long period of time.
Right.
And you started looking at that from the standpoint of the genetics of the plant to assess the variability that might exist, as well as to give attention to the cultural practices. Let's concentrate primarily here on the genetic aspect of it, because I know that without excluding any other important points, how did you go about assessing that variability?
Well, the first thing I did, of course, I didn't know very much, and so I had to inquire at a rather basic level. I suppose, to be honest, I must confess that the first thing I did was to talk extensively with the people who had been working with the crop and who told me about its problems and shortcomings and what kinds of things they had run into in trying to improve.
Now, this was your first real experience with peanuts.
Absolutely. I had never grown peanuts.
You were a geneticist assigned to work with peanuts.
That's correct. And so I went around after talking with Dr. Middleton and Dr. Harvey and, to some extent, Dr. Lovren, all of whom had worked on peanuts. I went with Dr. Middleton to visit the experimental plots and become somewhat acquainted with what the plants looked like in the field, what kind of differences existed between the plant rows that he had planted out in his nursery and so on. And I could see for myself that from the data that he had collected, as well as the appearance in the field, that very little variation actually existed, and he had successfully exploited a good deal of what did exist. It shouldn't be forgotten that at this time, Dr. Higgins was working in Georgia and Dr. Carver was working in Florida. And of course, it wasn't very long before I was in contact with those people, and they had somewhat of a lead on me with respect to starting out a program and were doing some very fine work, and ultimately led to some of the most successful breeding work in the world, and peanuts that were released by the Florida station and by the Georgia station in later years. And as you know, I think I'm speaking correctly, peanuts is now the leading crop in the state of Georgia.
I didn't realize that.
If I could be corrected, well, if I'm wrong, but it is a very important crop there. And in North Carolina, we began our program much influenced by what I had seen happen in a very different plant, the corn plant, behave under breeding selection pressure following hybridization. I proceeded to hybridize the most different kinds of peanuts I could find in the program, and I got Dr. Middleton to help me isolate what he considered the 10 most different divergent strains of peanuts he had, irrespective of their productivity, but to include the most productive, because the divergence had to be in productivity as well as in appearance and plant type and that sort of thing. And so these 10 lines, my first effort and the very first summer that I worked, I put them into all possible single cross combinations, which amounted to, and when the cross was made one way, we amounted to 45 different hybrids, and I proceeded to make cuttings of the hybrids to increase them, and tested the cuttings themselves. I rooted the cuttings and carried them to the field and tested them as F1s, and found a very considerable difference in the performance of F1s, as well as a contribution to that performance by particular strains of peanuts. That is, I was able to identify parental material which consistently improved in the case of the best ones, practically anything in the 10 lines with which they were compared that they crossed with. And so by identifying these parents, I find today that those same parental backgrounds are important in the production of peanuts. And after all these years, it's surprising to me, but they still show in the complex ancestry, of course, not in direct individual lines, but in the parental contribution, these lines still show in very important productive statistics in India, in South America, in Georgia, and in North Carolina.
Dr. Gregory, I know that we could go indefinitely on the technical aspects of this work. Much of this is, of course, well documented in the various publications that you have issued. I wonder if we could move now more or less into the highlight developments and sort of get what you regard as the major breakthroughs that have occurred following this rather carefully designed, sometimes maybe depending on what was already there, but then as time went on, carefully designed program. What were the big breakthroughs that you encountered as you moved into this work?
Well, I'm not sure I'm prepared to say that there were big breakthroughs in the first place. Breeding science doesn't usually lend itself to big breakthroughs. The improvement of plants by big breakthrough has been publicized by the advent of hybrid corn back in the 30s. And of course, this was a big breakthrough, but it's almost unique with corn, although we could find such a breakthrough in peanuts and did in our first experiment, but it's impossible to utilize such hybrid vigor at the initial level in self-pollinating crops, of which peanuts is an example. Corn is an almost totally outcrossed crop and has more, even a more widespread outcrossing breeding system than animal breeding systems, which have to be outcrossed. And these ideas have been used in animal breeding, for example, but in the case of our self-pollinated crop, up until now, we didn't have big breakthroughs. What we had was the discovery of parental material which could be exploited by systematic breeding and selection processes.
But you did start bringing out some new varieties that were substantial.
Yes. Now, in terms of agronomic breakthrough, this is a little different type of breakthrough.
Yeah.
We made a breakthrough with the release of our first variety, NC2, which came from this program I described. And the best parental material was not represented in NC2 because the market classifications of saleable product were such that the best parental material from the standpoint of productivity produced seeds which were not marketable in our market at that time. And it has only been through successive hybridization and reselection that people who have succeeded me in plant breeding of peanuts have managed to bring these really superior plants into the market.
What kind of a yield would the NC2 yield under, say, average good conditions?
Well, our yields immediately went up into away from the under the conditions of those days, which agronomically were quite inferior to the conditions under which one would be testing the same varieties today. But under those conditions, we moved from experiment station yields from around 2,000 pounds per acre up to 2,500 to 3,000, mm-hmm. and immediately.
Well, that's the thing that I was thinking of as a major...
Yeah, well, agronomically, there were breakthroughs.
Yes.
But, of course, this, from an extension standpoint, an agricultural production standpoint, and from the standpoint of the economic motivation and the recognition of opportunity by human beings, NC2 played a very vital role in North Carolina. The Extension Service was immediately able to take this new variety out to the growers and tell them that this plant will do something for you which none of your old varieties has the capability of doing. But and they succeeded in selling enough of the farm leadership on the value of the plant to get a test base at the broad agricultural farm front. And once this was accomplished, the Extension Service was then able to say, but this is not all. Because if you take the new variety and these practices together, then you can accomplish even more. And by that time, the incentive was in the souls of the people who had to do the work. And they saw the economic advantages thereof, and immediately they went to work and applied the practice, other agronomic practices, which other research people were generating, not the peanut breeding program at all. And this can't be overemphasized in the experiment station work, and that is the unanimity of effort and the confluence of the different efforts of the various branches of the station on the whole farm community. And for example, one of the things that should be emphasized in the case of our peanut production in North Carolina today, that is that the success of the hybrid corn program had a direct impact on the ability of peanuts to produce in the corn-peanut rotation, which is so common throughout the district today.
And I suppose that a few of these things, the accumulative effect would be that the minds of the producers is open to look for things that they haven't thought about before.
The accumulative effect, Dean, is that now, and for some years in the past, it is not only in the minds are open to receive information, those men demand information. In
yeah.
fact, we are hard put to produce information that will satisfy them. The whole world of extension has turned around.
But it seems to me that that is an extremely important point as it relates to the total progress that's been made.
Undoubtedly, the whole... as a matter of fact, the average peanut grower out there today knows so much more about producing peanuts than I do that it's ludicrous. Here I was telling them how to do a few years ago, and now I would be educated by them if I were a wise person.
Well, I've said many times that we probably ought to put the mobilizing of knowledge right on the par with the creation of knowledge.
Oh, golly, that's fantastic.
Where did the... at what stage did you introduce the technique of radiation to increase the variability?
Well, right at the beginning, I did the thing which was necessary and proper for the peanut breeding program, and that is I went to the Plant Introduction Service and the U.S. Department of Agriculture and to Dr. Baver with a request that they finance an expedition into South America where peanuts are native to collect all the different land races and wild relatives of peanuts that existed there. And it turns out that as so often is the case you mentioned earlier, that in the case of a hybrid corn program, that funds can be absolutely limiting, crucial, or motivating in the accomplishments of people in this kind of work, or perhaps any kind of work. And the funds simply were not there. And lacking the funds to expand the varietal base of the of peanuts in the United States, I proceeded to try to accumulate as many different varieties as I could by writing to all the botanic gardens and agricultural institutes around the world, and that is around the world. And we received peanuts from Java, mainland China, which was then not communist mainland China, and South America and Africa. And that process is still going on, and the interchange is enormous now. But we actually got the ball rolling and were the source in the early 70s of much of the variety that the rest of the world was asking for, because we had accumulated it in the United States. When I say we, I'm referring to other experiment stations as well as to the Department of Agriculture.
So you increased the variation in your plantings by collections from around the world, as well as by...
Right. Well, the point is that this letter writing process was slow, and being young, I couldn't wait. And I initiated the introduction of artificial induction of variation in peanuts as a substitute for what was a more natural thing to do, and in addition to. So while we wrote letters, we irradiated the peanuts with x-rays.
Where did you do that?
And this work was done at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, at the National Lab there, the old Atomic Energy Commission establishment.
You had relatively few options as to where you could do it at that time.
Well, as a matter of fact, we created, even for a facility as large as the one at Oak Ridge, we created quite a problem by demanding physical resources. The genetics of the problem demanded physical resources that were hardly adequate to the job, and we got into some difficulty with the people in Oak Ridge because we burned out their x-ray tubes and did things, even though their equipment was of the very best at the time.
I think the important point here is that that was the very beginning of the capability of doing this kind of work in this country, wasn't it?
Well, the real beginnings went back to the famous work of Dr. Muller on the effect of x-rays on Drosophila flies, believe that or not, in connection with plant breeding. But this is true, it's 1927. And simultaneously of Dr. Stadler on the effect of x-rays on variability in corn. Now, he didn't need the variability in the corn, and Dr. Muller, of course, didn't need anything in the flies except as an experimental unit. But they showed that genetic changes were possible by means of penetrating radiations.
Okay, now you, what was the source of the seed that you used for radiation studies?
The source of the seed was the improved variety that Dr. Middleton had selected among NC Bunch peanuts, which I mentioned earlier, NC4.
Which was about the best thing we had at that time.
About the best thing we had in bunch peanuts in North Carolina.
And which, if planted, would have yielded a fairly uniform crop.
A very uniform crop. He had done this on a plant row basis and selected for several cycles so that the NC4 was as uniform as this plant could be practically made.
Okay, now you exposed this to the radiation and planted it, and then what happened?
Well, the first thing that happened, of course, was that we planted the irradiated peanuts themselves, and they were very badly hurt by the radiation. They were damaged cytologically and physiologically, and they had some very bizarre and distorted forms of plant life in that planting. We planted about 200 pounds, I think it was. And among those, we noticed a very considerable variation in the amount of damage shown in the plants. Well, we knew that the damage was to cytological structures in the cells other than the nucleus, which was carrying the hereditary material. And it was only in the hereditary changes that we were interested, so we had to move on from that stage to find out what had happened in the nucleus itself. And what we did, of course, was plant the, as scientists are wont to do, we classified all the, what we call the first generation changes into degrees of damage, all the way from perfectly normal plants down to plants which were so badly damaged they would not even bloom and never produced a seed. And we later showed that the quantity of variation was positively correlated with the degree of damage on the plants, believe it or not. It was a rather unusual find, but we had thought from theoretical grounds that this would not be true, but it was.
But you were able to make selections out of these this great variation that you introduced.
What we found that the variation was of nominal, if not minimal, usefulness from an agronomic standpoint, that we could improve the peanuts by selecting in post-irradiated generations of peanuts, but we proved without any doubt the fundamental law that had been put forward by R.A. Fisher on theoretical grounds, that the probability of improvement diminished as a function of the magnitude of change that you introduced. So the bigger the changes we made in the peanuts, the less probability there was that they would be adapted to our environment and produce an excellent crop. So we discovered that in this way, that the only variation which was really useful to us was the very, very small changes. And so we investigated the small changes. When we did that, we found that the frequency of small changes in terms of the frequency of plants exhibiting small changes. This is a plant frequency, not a gene frequency that I'm talking about. We discovered that that frequency increased geometrically with the diminution of change. In other words, what we showed was that Fisher was so right, and that is that the smaller the change, the higher the probability was of improvement, up to about 50% probability. And therefore we proceeded to go at the problem experimentally and from a statistical standpoint, where we estimated the productivity of plants in which the magnitude of change was known to be small, and in that case showed distinctive improvement under selection. However, we discovered that the price that we had paid was in time, and it had took more time to find and accumulate those small changes, even though they were 50% probability or thereabouts of being improvements. It still took a long time to discover those improvements compared, for example, to taking two improved varieties of peanuts which differed fundamentally in the nature of their advantages, and hybridizing those and taking advantage of the base that was built under natural success. And so once we were able to get the collaboration of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Plant Introduction Office, we took off to South America to do what we had proposed some 10 years earlier, and concentrated our efforts in necessarily in the practical field and taking advantage of what variation existed in the land races of the world.
But it seems to me that we have here in this discussion a very wonderful example of how a scientist goes about using the techniques that are known and understood only by the scientists, but how this work expresses itself into ultimately in economic terms to the farmer, and that here you've used various processes of selection, some processes of actually creating variation, and you've used the process of searching out the variation that exists in different parts of the world, and that these things combine and you got a better peanut. Now what would be the average yield of peanuts, maybe you said this earlier, in the state now?
Well, I haven't seen the figures. I'm out of touch really at the present time with the ongoing peanut production. But last year was a good year, and the last average I had seen was about 2,700 pounds average, which means that some of the men are growing 5,000 pounds a week.
Are there any other major scientific tools that you use? For example, the phytotron, was it? Did you use that to any degree?
Well, our graduate students mostly used the phytotron, but after we grew sufficiently to have students and assistants and technicians and all that around, it took so much of our time managing the whole program, and also we were the ones who were extensively absent in the world making speeches and collecting peanuts, that actually our graduate students made more use of the phytotron than we did.
But it was a tool that was adaptable to your purposes.
Absolutely.
Again, it's another one of those techniques that was introduced, or research tools that was introduced as time goes on. Of course, you gained a lot of, I don't know whether notoriety is the right word or not.
Probably.
Because of the so-called atomic peanut.
Right.
And that was, in effect, a variety that was produced out of this series of selection processes. It was glamorized somewhat.
The atomic peanut was glamorized beyond its worth, really. The atomic peanut got its name because it was a pure selection out of the radiation program and not a result of hybridizing materials which had been irradiated. Much more significant a contribution by the radiation program was insect resistance, corn root worm and thrips resistance, which have been incorporated in some of our varieties by normal breeding processes.
Our tape's coming close to an end here, and I wanted to get in a few other things. I think it follows that a person who's been as deeply involved as you have been in scientific work, certainly with the successes you've achieved, would be recognized for these achievements in various ways. You were recognized by the State Awards Commission with a citation for your scientific achievement. I know that. I believe you were recognized by the university as the Gardner. Did you receive the Gardner Award?
I received the Gardner Award.
So you received the state's highest honor for scientific achievement presented by the governor. You received the Gardner Award, which is the highest citation presented by the so-called Consolidated University System. Were you a Reynolds professor?
Yes, I was.
You were supported by the funds from the William Neal Reynolds professorships, and I'm sure you must have received a number of honors in the agronomic world. Would you mind just naming a few of those?
Well, I don't recall specific honors beyond those associated with the work right here in North Carolina. I was accorded a great deal of trust and and faith, you might say, in the very successful acquisition of funding for all of the international work that I was associated with in later years, and which the funds came from the United Nations rather than from a single country.
Well, now, what were you doing in this international travel, just in a general sense?
Well, I was working for FAO, really out of Rome, in the Genetics Resources Unit, which were trying to establish a base of germplasm resources in peanuts for the new international research center to be located at Hyderabad, India.
Dr. Gregory, one other question I want to be sure and get in here before this run to the end of this tape. You have been associated with and in a position to observe closely the School of Agriculture for a long period of time now. Work such as the work that you've been involved in has brought a great deal of acclaim to the School of Agriculture. Why do you think the School of Agriculture has moved from one of relatively little renown in the country